to bite the side of my neck, I realized that she did not intend to teach me magic. Or if she did, it was magic of a different kind. While it was not the subject I'd hoped to study under her, it's fair to say that I was not entirely disappointed. Learning lover's arts from Felurian far outstripped any curriculum offered at the university. I'm not referring to the vigorous, sweaty wrestling most men, and alas, most women, think of as love. While sweat and vigor are pleasant parts of it, Felurian brought to my attention the subtler pieces. If I were to go into the world, she said, I would not embarrass her by being an incompetent lover, and so she took care to show me a great many things. A few of them in her words. The pinioned wrist, the sigh toward the ear, devouring the neck, drawing the lips, the kissing of the throat, the navel, and, as Felurian phrased it, the woman's flower. The breathing kiss, the feather kiss, the climbing kiss, so many different types of kissing, too many to remember. Almost. There was drawing water from the well, the fluttering hand, bird song at morning, circling the moon, playing ivy, the harrowed hair. Just the names would fill a book. But this, I suppose, is not the place for such things. Alas, then, for the world. I don't mean to give the impression that all our hours were spent in dalliance. I was young, and Felurian was immortal, but there is only so much two bodies can endure. The rest of the time we amused ourselves in other ways. We swam and ate. I played songs for Felurian, and she danced for me. I asked Felurian a few careful questions about magic, not wanting to offend her by prying at her secrets. Unfortunately, her answers were not particularly enlightening. Her magic came as naturally as breathing. I might as well have asked a farmer how seeds sprouted. When her answers weren't hopelessly nonchalant, they were puzzlingly cryptic. Still, I continued to ask, and she answered as best she could, and occasionally I felt a small spark of understanding. But most of our time was spent telling stories. We had so little in common that stories were all that we could share. You might think Felurian and I would be unevenly matched in this regard. She was older than the sky, while I was not yet 17. But Felurian was not the narrative treasure trove you would think. Powerful and clever? Certainly. Energetic and lovely? Absolutely. But storytelling was not among her many gifts. I, on the other hand, was of the Edema Rue, and we know all the stories in the world. So I told her The Ghost and the Goose Girl. I told her Tam and the Tinker's Spade. I told her stories of woodcutters and widows' daughters and the cleverness of orphan boys. In exchange, Felurian told me Manling stories. The Hand at the Heart of the Pearl. The Boy Who Ran Between. The Fae have their own cast of legendary characters. Maven the Man-Shaped. Alvin Allface. Surprisingly, Felurian had never heard of Taberlin the Great or Orin Velsitor, but she did know who Ilion was. It made me proud that one of the Edema Rue had gained a place in the stories the Fae tell each other. I wasn't blind to the fact that Felurian herself might have the information I was looking for about the Aemir and the Chandrian. How much more enjoyable would it be to learn the truth from her rather than rooting endlessly through ancient books and dusty rooms? Unfortunately, Felurian wasn't the mine of information I'd hoped. She knew stories of the Aemir, but they were thousands of years old. When I asked her about the more recent Aemir, asking about church knights in the Ciri Day with their bloody tattoos, she merely laughed.
There were never any human Aemir, she said, dismissing the idea out of hand. Those you speak of sound like children dressing in their parents' clothes.
While I might expect that reaction from others, getting it from Felurian was particularly disheartening. Still, it was nice to know I had been right about the Aemir existing long before they became Knights of the Talon Church. Then, since the Aemir were a lost cause, I tried to steer her in the direction of the Chandrian.
No,
she said, looking me squarely in the eye, her back straight.
I will not speak of the Seven.
Her soft voice held no lilting whimsy, no playfulness, no room for discussion or negotiation. For the first time since our initial conflict, I felt a trickle of icy fear sweep over me. She was so slight and lovely. It was so easy to forget what she truly was. Still, I couldn't let the subject go so easily. This was, quite literally, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. If Felurian could be persuaded to tell me even a piece of what she knew, I could learn things no one else in the world might know. I gave her my most charming smile and drew a breath to speak, but before I could get the first word out, Felurian leaned forward and kissed me full upon the mouth. Her lips were plush and warm. Her tongue brushed mine, and she bit the swell of my lower lip playfully. When she pulled her mouth from mine, it left me breathless with a racing heart. She looked at me, her dark eyes full of tender sweetness. She laid her hand along my face, brushing my cheek as gently as a flower.
"My sweet love," she said, "if you ask of the seven again in this place, I will drive you from it. No matter if your asking be firm or gentle, honest or slantways, if you ask, I will whip you forth from here with a lash of brambles and snakes. I will drive you before me, bloody and weeping, and will not stop until you are dead or fled from Fay."
She didn't look away from me as she spoke, and though I hadn't looked away or seen them change, her eyes were no longer soft with adoration. They were dark as storm clouds, hard as ice.
"I do not jest," she said. "I swear this by my flower and the ever-moving moon. I swear it by salt and stone and sky. I swear this singing and laughing by the sound of my own name."
She kissed me again, pressing her lips to mine tenderly.
"I will do this thing."
And that was the end of it. I might be a fool, but I am not that much of a fool. Felurian was more than willing to talk about the Fey realm itself, and many of her stories detailed the fractious politics of the Feyan courts. The Toyn Mael, the Daen Dan, the Gorse Court. These stories were difficult for me to follow, as I didn't know anything about the factions involved, let alone the web of alliances, false friendships, open secrets, and old grudges that bound Fey society together. This was complicated by the fact that Felurian took it for granted that I understood certain things. If I were telling you a story, for example, I wouldn't bother mentioning that most moneylenders are Sealdish, or that there is no royalty older than the Modagan royal line. Who doesn't know such things? Felurian left similar details out of her stories. Who wouldn't know, for example, that the Gorse Court had meddled in the Baron Talfa between the Mael and the House of Fine? And why was this important? Well, of course, that would lead to members of the Gorse being scorned by those on the Dayward side of things. And what was the Baron Talfa? A sort of dance. And why was this dance important? After a handful of questions such as this, Felurian's eyes would narrow. I quickly learned it was better to follow along, quiet and confused, rather than try to winkle out every detail and risk her irritation. Still, I learned things from these stories, 1,000 small scattered facts about the Fey. The names of the courts, old battles, and notable persons. I learned you must never look at one of the Theana with both eyes at once, and that the gift of a single Sinus fruit is considered a terrible insult if given to one of the Beladari. You might think these 1,000 facts gave me some insight into the Fey, that I somehow fit them together like puzzle pieces and discovered the true shape of things. 1,000 facts is quite a lot, after all. But no. 1,000 seems like a lot, but there are more stars than that in the sky, and they make neither a map nor a mural. All I knew for certain after hearing Felurian's stories is that I had no desire to ever entangle myself in even the kindest corner of the Feyan court. With my luck, I'd whistle while walking under a willow and thereby insult God's barber or something of the sort. Here is the one thing I learned from these stories. The Fey are not like us. This is endlessly easy to forget because many of them look as we do. They speak our language. They have two eyes. They have hands, and their mouths make familiar shapes when they smile. But these things are only seemings. We are not the same. I have heard people say that men and the Fae are as different as dogs and wolves. While this is an easy analogy, it is far from true. Wolves and dogs are only separated by a minor shade of blood. Both howl at night. If beaten, both will bite. No. Our people and theirs are as different as water and alcohol. In equal glasses, they look the same, both liquid, both clear, both wet after a fashion. But one will burn, the other will not. This has nothing to do with temperament or timing. These two things behave differently because they are profoundly, fundamentally not the same. The same is true with humans and the Fae. We forget it at our peril. Chapter 100. Shade. I should perhaps explain a few peculiarities of the Fae. At first glance, Felurian's forest glade did not seem particularly odd. In most ways, it resembled an ancient, untouched piece of forest. If not for the unfamiliar stars above, I might have suspected I was still in an isolated piece of the Eld. But there were differences. Since I had left my mercenary companions, I had slept perhaps a dozen times. Despite this, the sky above Felurian's pavilion remained the deep purpling blue of summer dusk and showed no signs of changing. I had only the roughest guess as to how long I had been in the Fae. More importantly, I had no idea how much time might have been passing in the mortal world. Stories are full of boys who fall asleep in fairy circles only to wake as old men. Young girls wander into the woods and return years later looking no older and claiming only minutes have passed. For all I knew, years could pass each time I slept in Felurian's arms. I could return to find a century had passed, or no time at all. I did my best not to think about it. Only a fool worries over what he can't control. The other difference in the Fae realm was much more subtle and difficult to describe. In the Medica, I had spent a fair amount of time around unconscious patients. I mention this to make a point. There is a great difference between being in a room that is empty and being in a room where someone is sleeping. A sleeping person is a presence in a room. They are aware of you, even if it is only a dim, vague awareness. That is what the Fae was like. It was such an odd, intangible thing that I didn't notice it for a long while. Then, once I became aware of it, it took me much longer to lay my finger on what the difference was. It felt as if I had moved from an empty room into a room where someone was asleep, except, of course, that there was no one there. It was as if everything around me was deeply asleep. The trees, the stones, the rippling stream that widened into Felurian's pool. All these things felt more solid, more present than I was used to, as if they were ever so slightly aware of me. The thought that I would eventually leave the Fae alive and unbroken was an unfamiliar one for Felurian, and I could tell it troubled her. Often, while in the midst of an unrelated conversation, she would change direction and make me promise to return to her. I reassured her as best I could, but there are only so many ways you can say the same thing. After perhaps 36 times, I said, "I will do my best to keep myself safe so I can come back to you." I saw her face change, becoming first anxious, then grim, then thoughtful. For a moment, I worried she had decided to keep me as a pet mortal after all, and I began to berate myself for not fleeing the Fae when I had the chance. But before I could begin to grow genuinely concerned, Felurian cocked her head to one side and seemed to change the subject. "Would my sweet flame like a coat? A cloak?" "I have one," I said, gesturing to where my possessions lay scattered at the edge of the pavilion. Only then did I notice that the tatty old tinker's cloak wasn't there. I saw my clothes, my boots, and my travel sack still bulging with the mayor's lockbox, but my cloak and sword were gone. The fact that I hadn't noticed their absence was understandable, as I hadn't bothered dressing since I first woke next to Felurian. She looked me over slowly, her expression intent, her eyes lingering on my knee, my lower arm. my upper arm. It was only when she took hold of my shoulder, turned me so she could examine my back, that I realized she was looking at my scars. Felurian took hold of my hand and traced a pale line that ran along my forearm.
"You are not good at keeping yourself safe, Mykvoth."
I was a little offended, especially as there was more than a little truth to what she said. "I do fairly well," I said stiffly, "considering the trouble that I find." Felurian turned over my hand and examined my palm and fingers closely.
"You are not a fighter,"
she mused softly to herself.
"Yet you are all iron-bitten. You are a sweet bird that cannot fly. No bow, no knife, no chain."
Her hand moved to my foot, running thoughtfully along the calluses and scars from my years on the streets of Tarbian.
"You are a long walker. You find me in the wild at night. You are a deep knower, and bold, and young, and trouble finds you."
She looked up at me, her face intent.
"Would my sweet poet like a shade?"
"A what?" She paused as if considering her words.
"A shadow."
I smiled. "I already have one." Then I checked to make sure. I was in the Fae, after all. Felurian frowned, shaking her head at my lack of understanding.
"Another I would give a shield, and it would keep him safe from harm. Another I would gift with amber, bind a scabbard tight with glamour, or craft a crown so men might look on you with love."
She shook her head solemnly.
"But not for you. You are a nightwalker, a moon follower. You must be safe from iron, from cold, from spite. You must be quiet. You must be light. You must move softly in the night. You must be quick and unafraid."
She nodded to herself.
"This means I must make you a shade."
She stood and started walking toward the forest.
"Come," she said.
Felurian had a way of making requests that took some getting used to. I discovered that unless I was steeling myself to resist, I'd find myself automatically doing whatever it was she asked of me. It wasn't that she spoke with authority. Her voice was too soft and edgeless to carry the weight of command. She did not demand or cajole. When she spoke, it was matter of fact, as if she couldn't imagine a world in which you didn't want to do exactly as she said. Because of this, when Felurian told me to follow her, I jumped like a puppet with its strings pulled. Soon, I was padding along beside her, deep in the twilight shadows of the ancient forest, naked as a jaybird. I almost went back to grab my clothes, then decided to follow some advice my father had given me when I was young. "Everyone eats a different part of the pig," he'd said. "You want to fit in? You'll do the same. Different places, different decorums." So I followed, naked and unprepared. Felurian struck out at a good pace, the moss muffling the sound of our bare feet. As we walked, the forest grew darker. At first, I thought it was simply the branches of the trees arching over our heads. Then I realized the truth. Above us, the twilight sky was slowly growing darker. Eventually, the last hint of purple was gone, leaving the sky a perfect velvet black, flecked with unfamiliar stars. Felurian kept walking. I could see her pale skin in the starlight and the shapes of trees around us, but nothing more. Thinking myself clever, I made a sympathetic binding for light and held my hand above my head as if it were a torch. I was more than slightly proud of this, as the motion-to-light binding is rather difficult without a piece of metal to use as a focus. Light swelled, and I caught a moment's glimpse of our surroundings. Dark trunks of trees rose like massive pillars as far as the eye could see. There were no low-hanging branches, no undergrowth, no grass, only dark moss underfoot and the arch of dark branches overhead. I was reminded of a vast, empty cathedral swathed in sooty velvet.
"Ciarnalius!"
Felurian snapped. Understanding her tone, if not her words, I broke the binding and let the darkness rush back over us.
An instant later, Falurian leapt at me and bore me to the ground, her lithe, naked body pressed against mine. It was not an entirely uncommon occurrence, but this time, the experience was not particularly erotic as the back of my head struck a knuckle of protruding root. Because of this, I was half-dazed and nine-tenths blind when the earth shuddered slightly beneath us. Something vast and almost perfectly silent stirred the air above us and slightly off to one side of where we lay. Poised atop me, one leg on either side, Falurian's body was as taut as a harp string. The muscles of her thighs were tense and quivering. Her long hair fell over us, covering us like a silk sheet. Her breasts pressed against my chest as she drew a shallow, silent breath. Her body thrummed with the rhythm of her racing heart, and I felt her mouth move where it rested near the hollow of my throat. Softer than a whisper, Falurian spoke a gentle, edgeless word. I felt it press against my skin, sending silent ripples through the air the same way a thrown stone makes circles on the surface of a pond. There was a soft sound of movement above us, as if someone was folding a huge piece of velvet around a piece of broken glass. Saying that, I realize it makes no sense, but still, that is the best way I can describe the sound. It was a soft noise, the half-heard sound of deliberate movement. I cannot tell you why it made me think of something terrible and sharp, but it did. My forehead prickled with sweat, and I was filled with a sudden pure and breathless terror. Falurian went perfectly still, as if she were a startled deer or a cat about to pounce. Quietly, she drew a breath, then spoke a second word. Her breath brushed hot against my throat, and at the half-heard word, my body thrummed as if I were a drumhead soundly struck. Falurian turned her head a bare degree, as if straining to listen. This movement pulled a thousand strands of her splayed hair slowly over the entire left half of my naked body, covering me in goose flesh. Even in the grip of my nameless terror, I shivered and gave a soft, involuntary gasp. There was a stirring in the air directly above us. The sharp nails of Falurian's left hand dug hard into the muscle of my shoulder. She shifted her hips and slowly slid her naked body up along my own until her face was even with mine. Her tongue flicked against my lips, and without even thinking, I tilted my head, reaching for the kiss. Her mouth met mine, and she drew a long, slow breath, pulling the air out of me. I felt my head grow light. Then, her lips still tight against mine, Falurian pushed her breath hard into me, filling my lungs. It was softer than silent. It tasted of honeysuckle. The ground shivered beneath me, and everything was still. For an endless moment, my heart ceased beating in my chest. A subtle tension left the air above us. Falurian pulled her mouth from mine, and my heart thumped again, sudden and hard. A second beat. A third. I pulled in a deep, shaking breath. Only then did Falurian relax. She lay atop me, loose and supple, her naked body flowing over mine like water. Her head nestled into the curve of my neck, and she gave a sweet, contented sigh. A languid moment passed. Then she laughed, her body shaking with it. It was wild and delighted, as if she had just played the most marvelous joke. She sat up and kissed my mouth fiercely, then nipped at my ear before climbing off me and pulling me to my feet. I opened my mouth, then closed it, deciding this was probably not the right time for questions. Half of seeming clever is keeping your mouth shut at the right times. So we continued in darkness. Eventually my eyes adjusted, and through the branches above I could see the stars, differently patterned and brighter than those in the mortal sky. Their light was barely enough to give an impression of the ground and surrounding trees. Falurian's slender form was a silver shadow in the darkness. We kept walking, and the trees grew taller and thicker, blocking out the pale starlight bit by bit. Then it became truly dark. Falurian was little more than a piece of pale darkness ahead of me.
She stopped walking before I lost sight of her entirely and cupped her hands around her mouth as if she were about to shout. I cringed at the thought of a loud noise invading the warm quiet of this place. But instead of a shout, there was nothing. No, not nothing. It was like a low, slow purr. Not anything so loud and rough as a cat's purr. It was closer to the sound a heavy snowfall makes, a muffled hush that almost makes less noise than no noise at all. Valorian did this several times. Then she took me by the hand and led me farther into the dark where she repeated the odd, almost inaudible noise. After she had done this three times, it was so dark I could no longer see even the faintest shape of her. After the final pause, Valorian stepped close to me in the dark, pressing her body to mine. She gave me a long and thorough kiss that I expected to become something more involved when she pulled away and spoke softly into my ear.
Quietly, she breathed. They come.
For several minutes, I strained my eyes and ears to no avail. Then, I saw something luminous in the distance. It disappeared quickly, and I thought my light-starved eyes were playing tricks on me. Then I saw another flicker. Two more. 10. 100 pale lights danced toward us through the trees, faint as foxfire. I'd heard of fool's fire before, but never seen it. And given that we were in the Fae, I doubted this was anything so mundane. I thought of 100 fairy stories and wondered which of those creatures could be responsible for these dim, madly dancing lights. Tom Sparks? Will-o'-wisps? Dennerlings with lanterns full of corpse light? Then they were all around us, startling me. The lights were smaller than I'd thought, and closer. I heard the hushed snowfall sound again, this time from all around me. I still couldn't guess what they might be until one of them brushed my arm as lightly as a feather. They were moths of some sort. Moths with luminescent patches on their wings. They shone with a pale silvery light too weak to illuminate anything around them. But hundreds of them, dancing between the boles of trees, showed the silhouette of our surroundings. Some of them lit on trees or the ground. A few landed on Valorian, and though I still could not see more than a few inches of her pale skin, I could use the moving light of them to follow her. We walked a long while after that, Valorian leading between the trunks of ancient trees. Once I felt grass soft beneath my bare feet instead of moss. Then there was soft soil, as if we were crossing a farmer's fresh-tilled field. For a time, we followed a twisting path of smooth, paved stones that led us over the arch of a high bridge. All the while, the moths followed us, giving me only the dimmest impression of our surroundings. Eventually, Valorian stopped. By now, the darkness was so thick, I could almost feel it like a warm blanket around me. I could tell by the sound of the wind in the trees and the motion of the moths that we were standing in an open space. There were no stars above us. If we were in a clearing, the trees must be vast for their branches to meet overhead. But for all I knew, we could just as easily be deep underground. Or perhaps the sky was black and empty in this portion of the Fae. It was a strangely unsettling thought. The subtle feeling of sleeping alertness was stronger here. If the rest of the Fae felt like it was sleeping, this place felt like it had stirred half a moment ago and hovered on the verge of waking. It was disconcerting. Valorian gently pressed the flat of her hand against my chest, then a finger against my lips. I watched as she moved away from me, softly humming a little snatch of the song I had made for her. But even this piece of flattery couldn't distract me from the fact that I was in the center of the Fae realm, blind, stark naked, and without the slightest idea of what was going on. A handful of moths had landed on Valorian, resting on her wrist, hip, shoulder, and thigh. Watching them gave me a vague impression of her movements. If I had to guess, I would have said she was picking things out of the trees, from behind or beneath bushes or stones. A warm breeze sighed through the clearing, and I felt strangely comforted as it brushed my bare skin. After about 10 minutes,
Felurian came back and kissed me. She held something soft and warm in her arms. We walked back the way we had come. The moths gradually lost interest in us, leaving us with less and less of an impression of our surroundings. After what seemed an interminable amount of time, I saw light filtering through a break in the trees ahead. It was only faint starlight, but at that moment, it seemed bright as a curtain of burning diamonds. I started to walk through it, but Felurian took hold of my arm to stop me. Without a word, she sat me down where the first faint beams of starlight lanced through the trees to touch the ground. Carefully, she stepped between the rays of starlight, avoiding them as if they might burn her. When she stood in the center of them, she lowered herself to the ground and sat cross-legged facing me. She held whatever she had collected in her lap, but other than the fact that it was shapeless and dark, I could tell nothing about it. Then, Felurian reached out a hand, took hold of one of the thin beams of starlight, and pulled it toward the dark shape in her lap. I might have been more surprised if Felurian's manner hadn't been so casual. In the dim light, I saw her hands make a familiar motion. A second later, she reached out again, almost absent-mindedly, and grasped another narrow strand of starlight between her thumb and forefinger. She drew it in as easily as the first, and manipulated it in the same way. Again, the motion struck me as familiar, but it was nothing I could press my finger to. Felurian started to hum quietly to herself as she gathered in the next beam of starlight, brightening things an imperceptible amount. The shape in her lap looked like thick, dark cloth. Seeing this, I realized what she reminded me of. My father sewing. Was she sewing by starlight? Sewing with starlight. Realization came to me in a flood. Shade meant shadow. She had somehow brought back an armful of shadow and was sewing it with starlight. Sewing me a cloak of shadow. Sound absurd? It did to me, but regardless of my ignorant opinion, Felurian took hold of another strand of starlight and brought it to her lap. I brushed any doubt aside. Only a fool disbelieves what he sees with his own eyes. Besides, the stars above me were bright and strange. I was sitting next to a creature out of a storybook. She had been young and beautiful for 1,000 years. She could stop my heart with a kiss and talk to butterflies. Was I going to start quibbling now? After a while, I moved closer so I could watch more carefully. She smiled as I sat next to her, favoring me with a hasty kiss. I asked a couple questions, but her answers either made no sense or were hopelessly nonchalant. She didn't know the first thing about the laws of sympathy or sigildry or the Alar. She simply didn't think there was anything odd about sitting in the forest holding a handful of shadow. First, I was offended. Then, I was terribly jealous. I remembered when I'd found the name of the wind in her pavilion. It had felt as if I were truly awake for the first time. True knowledge running like ice in my blood. The memory exhilarated me for a moment, then left me with a broken cord of loss. My sleeping mind was slumbering again. I turned my attention back to Felurian and tried to understand. Before too long, Felurian stood in a fluid motion and helped me to my feet. She hummed happily and took my arm as we strolled back the way we had come, chatting of little things. She held the dark shape of the shade draped easily over her arm. Then, just as the first faint hint of twilight began to touch the sky, she hung it invisibly in the dark branches of a nearby tree. "Sometimes slow seduction is the only way," she said. "The gentle shadow fears the candle flame. How could your fledgling shade not feel the same?" Chapter 101. Close Enough to Touch. After our shadow-gathering expedition, I asked more pointed questions about Felurian's magic. Most of her answers continued to be hopelessly matter-of-fact. "How do you take hold of a shadow?" She motioned with one hand as if reaching for a piece of fruit. That was how, apparently. Other answers were nearly incomprehensible, filled with fey words I didn't understand. When she tried to describe those terms, our conversations became hopeless rhetorical tangles. At times, I felt like I'd found myself a quieter, more attractive version of Elodin. Still,
I learned a few scraps. What she was doing with the shadow was called grammary. When I asked, she said it was the art of making things be. This was distinct from glamoury, which was the art of making things seem. I also learned that there aren't directions of the usual sort in the Fae. Your trifoil compass is useless as a tin codpiece there. North does not exist, and when the sky is endless twilight, you cannot watch the sun rise in the east. But if you look closely at the sky, one piece of the horizon will be a shade brighter, in the opposite direction, a shade darker. If you walk toward the brighter horizon, eventually it will become daytime. The other way leads to darker night. If you keep walking in one direction long enough, you will eventually see a whole day pass and end up in the same place you began. That's the theory, at any rate. Falorian described those two points of the Fae compass as day and night. The other two points she referred to at different times as dark and light, summer and winter, or forward and backward. Once she even referred to them as Grimward and Grinning, but something about the way she said it made me suspect it was a joke. I have a good memory. That, perhaps more than anything else, sits in the center of what I am. It is the talent upon which so many of my other skills depend. I can only guess how I came by my memory. My early stage training, perhaps. The games my parents used to help me remember my lines. Perhaps it was the mental exercises Abinthy taught me to prepare for the university. Wherever it came from, my memory has always served me well. Sometimes, it works much better than I'd like. That said, my memory is strangely patchy when I think of my time in the Fae. My conversations with Falurian are clear as glass. Her lessons may as well be written on my skin. The sight of her, the taste of her mouth, they are all fresh as yesterday. But other things I cannot bring to mind at all. For example, I remember Falurian in the purpling twilight. It dappled her through the trees, making her look as if she were underwater. I remember her in flickering candlelight, the teasing shadows of it concealing more than it revealed. And I remember her in the full, rich amber of lamplight. She basked in it like a cat, her skin warm and glowing. But I do not remember lamps, or candles. There is a great deal of fuss when dealing with such things, but I cannot remember a single moment spent trimming a wick or wiping soot from the glass hood of a lamp. I do not remember the smell of oil or smoke or wax. I remember eating fruit and bread and honey. Falurian ate flowers, fresh orchids, wild trillium, lush celis. I tried some myself. The violets were my favorite. I don't mean to imply she ate only flowers. She enjoyed bread and butter and honey. She liked blackberries especially. And there was meat, too. Not with every meal, but sometimes. Wild venison, pheasant, bear. Falurian ate hers so rare that it was almost raw. She was not a fastidious eater, either. Not prim or courtly. We ate with our hands and teeth, and afterward, if we were sticky with honey or pulp or the blood of bears, we would wash ourselves in the nearby pool. I can see her even now, naked, laughing, blood running down her chin. She was regal as a queen, eager as a child, proud as a cat, and she was like none of those things. Nothing like them. Not in the least bit. My point is this. I can remember our eating. What I cannot remember is where the food came from. Did someone bring it? Did she gather it herself? I cannot bring it to mind to save my life. The thought of servants intruding on the privacy of her twilight glade seems impossible to me, but so is the thought of Falurian baking her own bread. The deer, on the other hand, I could understand. I had not the least doubt she could run one to ground and kill it with her hands if she desired. Or I could picture a shy hart venturing into the quiet of her twilight glade. I can imagine Falurian sitting, patient and calm, waiting until it came close enough to touch. Chapter 102, The Ever-Moving Moon. Falurian and I were walking down to the pool when I noticed a subtle difference in the quality of light. Looking up, I was surprised to see the pale curve of the moon peering through the trees above us. Even though it was only the slenderest crescent, I recognized it as the same moon I had known my whole life. Seeing it in this strange place was like meeting a long-lost friend far from home.
"Look!" I said, pointing. "The moon!"
Valorian smiled indulgently.
"You are my precious newborn lamb. Look, there hangs a cloud as well. A Mawin! Dance for joy!"
She laughed. I flushed, embarrassed. "It's just that I haven't seen it in..." I trailed off, having no way to gauge my time. "A long while. Besides, you have different stars. I thought perhaps you had a different moon as well."
Valorian ran her fingers gently through my hair. "Foolish sweet, there is only one moon. We have been waiting on her. She will help us embiten your shade."
She slipped into the water, sleek as an otter. When she surfaced, her hair slicked her shoulders like ink. I sat on a stone by the edge of a pool and dangled my feet. The water was warm as a bath. "How can the moon be here?" I asked, "if this is a different sky."
"There is only one slender slip of her here," Valorian said. "She is still mostly in the mortal now."
"But how?" I asked. Valorian stopped swimming and floated on her back, looking up at the sky.
"Oh, moon," she said forlornly. "I perish for kisses. Why have you brought me an owl when I desired a man?"
She sighed, then softly hooted into the night.
"How, how, how?"
I slid into the water, not as lithe as an otter, perhaps, but somewhat better at kissing. A while later, we lay in the shallows, on a broad sheet of stone worn water smooth.
"Thank you, moon,"
Valorian said, looking up at the sky contentedly,
"for this sweet and lusty manling."
There were luminous fishes in the pool, no larger than your hand, each with a stripe or spot of gently glowing color. I watched them emerge from whatever hiding places they had scattered to, startled by the recent turbulence. They were orange as glowing coals, yellow as buttercups, blue as noontime sky. Valorian slid back into the water, then tugged at my leg.
"Come, my kissing owl," she said, "and I will show to you the workings of the moon."
I followed her into the pool until we stood shoulder deep. The fish came to explore, the braver ones coming close enough to swim between us. Their motion revealed the hidden silhouette of Valorian's body beneath the water. Despite the fact that I had explored her nakedness in great detail, I suddenly found myself fascinated by the suggested shape of her. The fish came closer still. One brushed me, and I felt a gentle nip against my ribs. I jumped, though its tiny bite was soft as a tapping finger. I watched as more of the fish circled round, occasionally nibbling at us.
"Even the fish delight in kissing you," Valorian said, stepping closer to press her wet body against mine.
"I think they must like the salt on my skin," I said, looking down at them. She pushed me away, irritated.
"Mayhap they like the taste of owl."
Before I could make an appropriate reply, she assumed a serious expression, flattened her hand, and lowered it into the water between us.
"There is only one moon," Valorian said. "She moves between your mortal sky and mine."
She pressed her palm against my chest, then brought it back and pressed it to her own.
"She sways between, back and forth."
She stopped, frowning at me.
"Be mindful of my words."
"I am," I lied.
"No, you are mindful of my breasts."
It was true. They flirted with the surface of the water. "They are well worth minding," I said. "To not attend to them would be a terrible insult."
"I speak of important things. Knowings you must have if you are to return safe to me."
She gave an exasperated sigh.
"If I let you touch one, will you attend to my words?"
"Yes." She took hold of my hand and pulled it close to cup her breast.
"Make waves upon lilies."
"You haven't shown me waves upon lilies yet."
That will come later, then.
She put her flat hand back in the water between us, then sighed softly, her eyes going halfway closed.
Ah, she said.
Oh.
Eventually, the fish emerged from their hiding places again.
My most distractible owl,
Valorian said, not unkindly. She dove to the bottom of the pool and returned holding a smooth, round stone.
Attend you now to what I say. You are the mortal, I the fae. Here is the moon, she said, tucking the stone between our palms and lacing our fingers together to hold it. She's tethered tight to both the fae and mortal knight.
Valorian stepped forward and pressed the stone against my chest.
Thus moves the moon, she said, tightening her fingers around mine. Now when I look above, there is no glimmer of the light I love. Instead, all like a flower unfurled, her face shines on your mortal world.
She stepped back so our arms were straight with our clasped hands between us. Then she pulled the stone toward her chest, dragging me through the water by my hand.
Now all your mortal maidens sigh, for she is fully in my sky.
I nodded, understanding. Beloved by both the fae and men, our moon's a merry wanderer, then.
Valorian shook her head. Not so. A traveler, yes. A wanderer, no. She moves but cannot freely go.
I heard a story once, I said, about a man who stole the moon.
Valorian's expression went solemn. She unlaced her fingers from mine and looked down at the stone in her hand. That was the end of it all, she sighed. Until he stole the moon, there was some hope for peace.
I was stunned by the matter-of-fact tone in her voice.
What?
I asked dumbly.
The stealing of the moon.
She cocked her head at me, puzzled.
You said you knew of it.
I said I'd heard a story, I said. But it was a silly thing. Not a story of what truly was. It was the sort of story that you tell a child.
She smiled again. You may call them fairy stories. I know of them. They are fancies. We tell our children manling tales betimes.
But the moon was truly stolen? I asked. That was no fancy?
Valorian scowled. This I have been showing you, she said, bringing her hand down in an angry splash.
I found myself making the Adem gesture for apology below the surface of the water before realizing it was doubly pointless. I'm sorry, I said, but without the truth of this story, I am lost. I beg of you to tell me it.
It is an old story, and a sad one.
She gave me a long look.
What then will you trade me?
The hushed heart, I said.
In that you give a gift that is a gift to you, she said archly. What else?
I will also make 1,000 hands, I said, watching her expression soften. And I will show you something new I have thought of all myself. I call it swaying against the wind.
She crossed her arms and looked away, making a great show of indifference. New, perhaps, to you. I doubtless know it by a different name.
Perhaps, I said, but if you will not trade, you cannot know.
Very well, she conceded with a sigh, but only because you are quite good at 1,000 hands.
Valorian looked up at the slender moon for a moment, then said,
Long before the cities of man, before men, before fae, there were those who walked with their eyes open. They knew all the deep names of things.
She paused and looked at me.
Do you know what this means?
When you know the name of a thing, you have mastery over it, I said.
No,
she said, startling me with the weight of rebuke in her voice.
Mastery was not given. They had the deep knowing of things, not mastery. To swim is not mastery over the water. To eat an apple is not mastery of the apple.
She gave me a sharp look.
Do you understand?
I didn't, but I nodded anyway, not wanting to upset her or sidetrack the story.
These old name-knowers moved smoothly through the world. They knew the fox, and they knew the hare, and they knew the space between the two. She drew a deep breath and let it out in a sigh. Then came those who saw a thing and thought of changing it. They thought in terms of mastery. They were shapers, proud dreamers. She made a conciliatory gesture. And it was not all bad at first. There were wonders. Her face lit with memory, and her fingers gripped my arm excitedly. Once, sitting on the walls of Mirella, I ate fruit from a silver tree. It shone, and in the dark, you could mark the mouths and eyes of all those who had tasted it.
Was Mirella in the Fae?
Felurian frowned. No, I have said, this was before. There was but one sky, one moon, one world, and in it was Mirella, and the fruit, and myself eating it, eyes shining in the dark.
How long ago was this?
She gave a small shrug. Long ago.
Long ago. Longer than any book of history I had ever seen or even heard of.
The archives had copies of Kelopteian histories that went back 2 millennia, and none of them held the barest whisper of the things Felurian spoke of.
Forgive my interruption, I said as politely as possible, and made as much of a bow to her as I could without going entirely underwater.
Mollified, she continued. The fruit was but the first of it. The early toddlings of a child. They grew bolder, braver, wild. The old knowers said stop, but the shapers refused. They quarreled and fought and forbade the shapers. They argued against mastery of this sort.
Her eyes brightened.
But oh, she sighed, the things they made. This from a woman weaving me a cloak out of shadow. I couldn't guess what she might marvel at.
What did they make?
She gestured widely around us.
Trees? I asked, awestruck.
She laughed at my tone. No, the Fane realm. She waved widely. Wrought according to their will. The greatest of them sewed it from whole cloth, a place where they could do as they desired, and at the end of all their work, each shaper wrought a star to fill their new and empty sky. Felurian smiled at me. Then there were 2 worlds. 2 skies, 2 sets of stars. She held up the smooth stone. But still 1 moon. And it all round and cozy in the mortal sky. Her smile faded. But 1 shaper was greater than the rest. For him the making of a star was not enough. He stretched his will across the world and pulled her from her home. Lifting the smooth stone to the sky, Felurian carefully closed 1 eye. She tilted her head as if trying to fit the curve of the stone into the empty arms of the crescent moon above us. That was the breaking point. The old knowers realized no talk would ever stop the shapers. Her hand dropped back into the water. He stole the moon, and with it came the war.
Who was it? I asked.
Her mouth curved into a tiny smile. She hooted.
Who? Who?
Was he of the Fane courts?
I prompted gently. Felurian shook her head, amused. No. As I said, this was before the Fae, the first and greatest of the Shapers.
What was his name?
She shook her head. No calling of names here. I will not speak of that one, though he is shut beyond the doors of stone.
Before I could ask more questions, Felurian took my hand and nestled the stone between our palms again.
This shaper of the dark and changing eye stretched out his hand against the pure black sky. He pulled the moon, but could not make her stay, so now she moves twixt mortal and the Fae. She gave me a solemn look, so rare a thing on her fair face. You have your tale, your who and how. There is a final secret now, so all your owlish listening lend.
She brought our joined hands back to the surface of the water.
This is the part on which you must attend.
Felurian's eyes were black in the dim light.
The moon has our 2 worlds beguiled, like parents clutching at a child, pulling at her to and fro, neither willing to let go.
She stepped away, and we stood as far apart as we could, the stone gripped in our hands.
When she is torn, half in your sky, you see how far apart we lie.
Valorian reached toward me with her free hand, making futile grasping gestures in the empty water.
No matter how we long to kiss, the space between us is not ripe for this.
Valorian stepped forward and pressed the stone close to my chest.
And when your moon is waxing full, all of Faerie feels the pull. She draws us close to you so bright. And now a visit for a night is easier than walking through a door or stepping off a ship that's near the shore.
She smiled at me.
'Twas thus while wandering in the wild you found Valorian, manling child.
The thought of an entire world of fey creatures drawn close by the swelling moon was troubling.
And this is true of any fey?
She shrugged and nodded.
Have they the will and know the way? There are 1,000 half-cracked doors that lead between my world and yours.
How have I never heard of this? It seems it would be hard to miss. Fey dancing on the mortal grass.
She laughed. But has not just this come to pass? The world is wide and time is long, but still you say you heard my song before you saw me singing there, brushing moonlight through my hair.
I frowned.
Still, it seems I should have seen more signs of those who walk between.
Valorian shrugged.
Most fey are sly and subtle folk, who step as soft as chimney smoke. Some go among your kind and shaden, glamoured as a pack mule laden, or wearing gowns to fit a queen.
She gave me a frank look.
We know enough to not be seen.
She took my hand again.
Many of the darker sort would love to use you for their sport. What keeps these from moonlit trespass? Iron, fire, mirror glass. Elm and ash and copper knives, solid-hearted farmers' wives who know the rules of games we play and give us bread to keep away. But worst of all, my people dread the portion of our power we shed when we set foot on mortal earth.
We are more trouble than we're worth, I admitted, smiling. Valorian reached out and touched a finger to my mouth.
While she is full, you may still laugh, but know there is a darker half.
She spun away to arm's length, pulling me through the water in a slow spiral.
A clever mortal fears the night without a hint of sweet moonlight.
She began to draw my hand to her chest, dragging me through the water toward her as she spun.
On such a night, each step you take might catch you in the dark moon's wake and pull you all unwitting into fey.
She stopped and gave me a grim look.
Where you will have no choice but stay.
Valorian took a step backward in the water, tugging at me.
And on such unfamiliar ground, how can a mortal help but drown?
I took another step toward her and found nothing beneath my feet. Valorian's hand was suddenly no longer clasping mine, and black water closed over my head. Blind and choking, I began to thrash desperately, trying to find my way back to the surface. After a long, terrifying moment, Valorian's hands caught me and dragged me into the air as if I weighed no more than a kitten. She brought me close to her face, her dark eyes hard and glittering. When she spoke, her voice was clear.
I do this so you cannot help but hear. A wise man views a moonless night with fear.
Chapter 103 Lessons. Time passed. Valorian took me dayward to a piece of forest even older and grander than the one that surrounded her twilight glade. There we climbed trees as tall and broad as mountains. In the highest branches, you could feel the vast tree swaying in the wind like a ship on the swelling sea. There, with nothing but the blue sky around us and the slow motion of the tree beneath, Valorian taught me ivy on the oak. I tried to teach Valorian tack, only to discover she already knew it. She beat me handily and played a game so lovely Brayden would have wept to look on it. I learned a bit of the fey tongue. A small bit. A scattering. Actually, in the interest of pure honesty, I will admit that I failed miserably in my attempt to learn the fey language. Valorian was a less than patient teacher, and the language bafflingly complex.
My failure went beyond mere incompetence to the point where Felurian actually forbade me from attempting to speak it in her presence. Overall, I gained a few phrases and a great dollop of humility.